Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your locally owned and independent businesses. I'm pleased to introduce this evening's guest speaker, author Joseph Cannon. Through his work, Joseph has received numerous awards. His first book, Los Alamos, won an Edgar Award for Best First Novel, and in 2007, he was given the Anne Frank Human Rights Award for his writings on the aftermath of the Holocaust. In 2005, Joseph won the Hammett Award of the International Association of Crime Writers, and during that same year, his book, Good German, had made its way into film. Tonight, Joseph is here to present his newest novel, Stardust. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Joseph Cannon.
These events are always billed as readings, but I prefer not to read, partly because I find it boring to be read to, and certainly to listen to myself is boring. And I think that people are much more interested in what in Hollywood would be called the backstory. What's the stuff behind what you're actually seeing? What's that story? And in this case, it's usually, where'd you get the idea? Why this book? How did it evolve? What does it mean to you? So I'm going to talk about the backstory of this book, and we will then do Q&As, but I want to anticipate this and just answer one question now. A few years ago, one of my books, The Good German, was made into a movie with George Clooney and Cate Blanchett, and it has nothing to do with the book, and it's a thing apart, but nevertheless it was made, and consequently I noticed that book events, people were restive and eager to get to the question period, so I've learned to anticipate and do this one first. Yes, I have met George Clooney. Yes, he is just as good looking as you think he is, and nice and charming and all those things. And no, I don't know him well enough to introduce you. So now, but the making of that movie is a perfect segue into talking about the book tonight. One of the reasons that Soderbergh, the director, wanted to do it is that he wanted to do a 40s story in the style of a 40s movie. He even to the point of using camera lenses that were available then. And the whole thing was shot on a soundstage or on the back lot. It was done the way a 1945 movie would have been done. And since that point, I was contemplating writing Stardust and writing a book about Hollywood exactly in that period. It was a wonderful gift to me because I actually got to see what it would have been like if you were making movies at that period. For any of you who know any of my books, you know that they always start with place. And Los Alamos, for instance, I literally had gone there as a tourist and became so interested that one thing led to another, and hence the book. Hollywood is often said to be a state of mind, but it's also a real place. And in the beginning, almost all the studios were there. They are now scattered throughout the Southern California basin. But at one point, Hollywood meant something as a real place. This book, however, did not begin there. It began, the germ of the idea, actually began in Berlin. In the 2 years that I was writing The Good German, I spent time sometimes on the streets of Berlin, but mostly in my head, in a city that had been utterly and morally, physically, in every way devastated by war. This was a society at its nadir. The book was about Germans who were trapped in their own society and who were now struggling with the consequences of this immense crime that had been committed, sometimes by them, sometimes in their name. And I thought, as I was doing this, but what about the others? What about the lucky ones, the ones who got out in time, who had traded their lives for exile, many of whom had come here. What was it like for them? This was how I started. And I thought, we all know a little bit about that migration. For those of you who don't, the emigres, the refugees from Hitler in the 30s, his one great gift to us, constituted the great intellectual diaspora of the century, and they had a profound impact on American society because they mostly came here. There was no field that was not touched by them. Nuclear physics, architecture, art, sociology, psychiatry, any of these fields was visibly enriched and made cutting edge and world class because of the addition of these fine minds. Life magazine used to refer to the 20th as the American century. And if that's so, a lot of the underpinnings of that mid-century triumph were German. But I was interested in the group that went to Los Angeles, partly because so few of us know that they did so, that they went there, including people in Los Angeles, by the way. And I thought, at one point, stuck all over the Pacific Palisades and the Hollywood Hills are these enclaves of European culture, and nobody seems to know about this. So I was intrigued. I wanted to know more. And I became even more interested because it seemed to me an anomaly, that this was an inherently dramatic collision of cultures. We are talking, after all, some of these people had escaped the Gestapo, sometimes by hours, and had got out with their lives. And they were often people for whom their birthright was the high culture of a Europe that was turning dark. They saw themselves as the last vestige of this kind of civilization. An example would be Alma Mahler, who's a character in the book, and was Mahler's widow, and indeed everyone else's mistress. But at the point that she was escaping, she climbed over the Pyrenees into neutral Spain as her way of getting out, carrying a suitcase which contained the original score of Bruckner's Fourth Symphony, which otherwise would have been lost. And as she said, I saved my life, but I was saving culture. Now they're in a city of milkshakes and drive-ins and Betty Grable movies and teenagers who have their own cars, another universe as far as they're concerned, and indeed as far as most Americans are concerned at that point. Los Angeles in 1945 is very, very different from the city that we know now and that has become the prototype for so many other American cities. There were, for instance, no freeways at all. There were still orange groves over swatches of the valley. People rode in streetcars still. The war had made it a boom town. No city in America profited as much from the war as Los Angeles, with its aircraft production and other industries. And in 1945, the population was about to explode and sprawl all over Southern California in that way that's familiar to us now. But that was a little later. Right now, as the emigre groups arrive in the early 40s and during the war, it seems to them and to most Americans a kind of paradise. It's palm trees and swimming pools, and people don't wear ties. They have open shirts, and they eat on patios. In fact, it's the prototype for the American dream life that everyone was to want after the war. It was happening there. And it also had movie stars. So they came. Thomas Mann, Heinrich Mann, Bertolt Brecht, Igor Stravinsky, Arnold Schoenberg. This is a who's who of 20th century culture. And they come because of the climate. It reminds them of the south of France, where some of them had been exiles. They come because of the cheaper cost of living. This is an historical novel that is no longer true. And they came for the movies, for the employment opportunities that might be available to them because they had connections or were just interested in this sort of thing. And what they found was indeed an Eden, a paradise, a haven. It rescued them. But it was a mixed bag Eden. It was also an Eden that could be extremely indifferent and sometimes even treacherous. There had always been Germans in Hollywood, in the film industry. There had been a to-ing and fro-ing all during the 20s and 30s, mostly a fro-ing, people coming to Hollywood. And some of the people that we now think of as iconic Hollywood figures, as American figures, were indeed German immigrants. Billy Wilder, William Wilder, Fritz Lang, Lubitsch, Peter Lorre, Marlene Dietrich, all these people had been settled there for years. But this later group have a very different time of it. This is a much more troubled and a much more desperate experience. The studios want Hope and Crosby. They want more of Dorothy L'Amour and a Serang. They're not interested in European intellectuals. Nobody is going to ask Arnold Schoenberg to score a movie or an Abbott and Costello. These are fat ears for the studios, and they don't need the kind of talents that these émigrés are bringing. The result is that they find it very tough going. Some of the actors, ironically, who have just escaped from the Nazis, find work playing Nazis. Some of the writers are offered so-called lifesaver contracts. The studios hire them for a year, and then to qualify for a visa, and then cut them loose. People who had been admired, who had been famous, and sometimes even revered in Europe, are now penniless and unknown. An example, there's a character in the book called Kaltenbach, who is loosely based on Heinrich Mann. This is Thomas's brother, and at one point he was much more famous than Thomas was in Germany. He had written The Blue Angel. He was a household word. Everyone knew who he was. Now nobody knows who he is. His books are not translated. He is living on handouts from his brother. He can't get arrested at the studios. His life is in despair. Worse, among all these other things, is that because these people are technically enemy aliens, they are also subject to curfews and restrictions, but fair enough, it's wartime. And they are also watched by the FBI, the very kind of secret police surveillance that they had come here to escape. The FBI, with its usual consideration for political nuance, really does not care that they are refugees from Hitler. Right wing, left wing, it doesn't matter to them. If they're foreign, they're suspect. The FBI's term for them, in fact, which is the title of a book that exists and very interesting if you are interested in this subject, was commu-Nazis. It's one's as bad as the other, and so what's the difference? We're going to watch them. That book, incidentally, has some of the reports that were filed by the FBI, and even 60 years later, you can still be furious at how your taxpayer dollars were wasted following Bertolt Brecht and his girlfriend to some hotel room, but such was life. But it may be that because of this experience and because of their sensitivity to this sort of political surveillance, that they are much more alert and attuned and aware of this sweeping change in the political climate that is coming to Hollywood right after the war, indeed across the country. Practically nobody else sees it coming. No one seems to predict or sense that Hollywood is about to come under siege, attacked by politicians who are wanting to borrow some of its stardust for their own purposes. But in 1945, why would you see the storm clouds? Stardust was deliberately said at this time because I wanted to do a book about Hollywood at the top of its game. This is an industry living through a boom that no one thought would ever end. The studios were bastions of privilege, hundreds and hundreds of contract employees, acres of standing sets on the back lots, their own police force, connections with downtown. The town was theirs. They could do as they like, and they were riding high. To be on one of these back lots was to be in case, it's a marvel of professionalism. Everyone around you has created this industrial machine, finely tuned, that is just churning out this entertainment product. What they were manufacturing were dreams. And in 1945, it seemed, these were the dreams that everyone wanted. More people went to the movies than would ever go again. All during the war, average weekly attendance was 85 million people, and the year after the war, 90 million people. And this in a population less than half of ours now. Despite shortages, even film was in short supply, and restrictions, Hollywood manages to turn out 400 films a year during the war. Almost all of them make money. The box office, U.S. domestic box office in 45 is $1.5 billion, and that's in 1940s dollars. Louis B. Mayer is the highest paid business executive in America. And 10 years later, it's gone. What happened? I became interested in this story because of the emigres who went to Hollywood. But as it evolved, it became very much a story about Hollywood itself, about this industry which is about to fall apart. And in its backstory, the backstory to the book, there will be the signs of the various forces that will cause this seismic change and really bring down the studio system. It's new technology, that would be television, new financing. They separated the theaters from the studios, so that monopolistic block was lost. New taste. People had different ideas after the war, but also their own moral cowardice or paralyzation in the face of this political attack that no one seemed to have expected. This was an industry that was praised all during the war for its patriotism. These are the people who brought you Yankee Doodle Dandy and Meet Me in St. Louis and these artifacts of Americana, the Andy Hardy generation. And now all of a sudden, they are subversive, un-American, a threat to our way of life. The way of life, in fact, that existed only in the movies. They are stunned, they are frightened, and ultimately they do what everybody did that period. I'm not singling out the studio moguls. They ran for cover. In 1947, at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, some 50 movie executives issued an anti-communist statement, which was in effect the blacklist and the beginning of a nefarious blacklist that would last for about 10 years. Stardust is about the beginning of this dark period in our history. Like some of the movies that are being made in its pages, it's a story of intrigue. There is a murder. There is a love story. But it's most of all about this industry blinded by its own success that cannot see what's coming. For our protagonist, Ben, what he has to struggle with is being able to see things as they are, unobstructed by stardust. A little earlier in the book, he had been at the observatory at Mount Wilson, which survived the recent fires, by the way, and was told that stardust, the real kind, the kind in the sky, gets in the way of seeing clearly. Now he finds that the Hollywood version, so seductive, so expertly manufactured, can do that too. What he discovers under this magic is not what he expected, and I hope it's not what you expect either, or otherwise the intrigue element sort of doesn't work. But in the post-war period that we're writing about, there are no simple endings anymore. Those crisp black and white films are turning very gray and very murky. Things are just not as clear-cut as they had been. And sometimes, perhaps, we don't want to see things as clearly as all that. But there is a price to be paid for it. In Stardust, some people will pay a price for not seeing clearly. And most of all, an industry will. An industry which has come just in a few decades from silly one-reelers, quickies. They would make three a week. People, cowboys, punching each other out in saloons, silly cops falling on their face. And within a space of a few short years, they had become the greatest entertainment machine that we have ever known, still. They were at the top. And night after night, gala premieres, as indeed as Stardust ends with a gala premiere, they would just flood the sky with more light, with Klieg lights, and make everything, and they would just simply dazzle you. They dazzled everybody for decades, including, here in this instance, fatally, themselves. That's what I think the backstory is to Stardust, and I hope you will enjoy it and see it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.